Okay, I think the recording has started. So today we're going to talk about monitoring and instrumentation with two superficially similar systems, right, for doing inserting instrumentation as opposed to build tools to do various kinds of dynamic analyses. I hope you got from sort of looking more carefully at the papers that they're actually quite different approaches, sort of a heavyweight versus a lightweight approach, which is why we look at these two systems. So let me bring up my slides. And what I'm going to do, I was afraid of that. So when I share my, I guess I get this view. I'm not going to go into full screen mode, because if I do that, then I lose, like, it's very hard to see what everything else that's going on in Zoom. So for this lecture, I won't do full screen. I'll just flip between the slides, using the slide view, okay? So the two systems we're going to look at today are ValGrind and Dyninst. I don't really have anything. I'm still working on logistics. I'm still working on grading for the OpenMP project. Are there any questions about the research projects? Anybody want to ask anything about the research projects? You'll have to speak up again, because I can't see you while I'm sharing the slides, other than I get a few of you on my side view, and I don't know how to make that bigger, which is really annoying. I can only see about half of you at a time. Anyway, if there are no questions, we can come back later once I stop sharing the slides, and it'll be easier to ask questions, I think, then. So what I'll do is I have a few slides about ValGrind and Dyninst, and then we can talk. So just sort of an overview of each of the two systems. So, and I think there are some misconceptions. So I think some of you might have actually used tools built with ValGrind. ValGrind is not a tool in and of itself. It's a framework for building dynamic binary analysis tools. So keywords, dynamic, okay? So it actually messes with your program at runtime, okay? It's the program that's running. Well, how? We'll talk about that. It works on program binaries, okay? Not source code, okay? So that has some advantages and disadvantages. And those are the key features. And it's also heavyweight, and we'll see why that is. So it works on program binaries. That means that the instrumentation is inserted before actually running code. So any instrumentation that a tool built using ValGrind is going to use is actually inserted before the program, before the code runs, not the entire program, because that's the way we'll talk about how it works. But what happens is the code gets modified before it's run, but it all happens sort of dynamically at runtime. Okay, it's not done up front and then the code just runs. It's all done dynamically. So what ValGrind itself does is it provides a set of basic services that a tool writer can use to perform various types of dynamic analysis on a running program. There's some examples in the paper, but also there's more on the webpage for ValGrind, talking about the kinds of tools people can build. People have built using ValGrind over now. It's actually, if you look at the webpage, this project now goes back 20 years, but it's still quite alive and active. So the basic mechanism that ValGrind uses for the tools is what's called shadow values. And what that really means is that the instrumentation is maintaining a copy of all the program state needed for an analysis tool to use. Okay, so the core maintains a set of program state, which means things like all the data in the stack, the heap, the registers, all the data that's being, and so that includes the machine registers, that is keeping track of all those values and allowing tools to basically manage those shadow values to actually keep track of state that's additional state that's needed for whatever the purpose of the tool is. Okay. So they talk about for a dynamic binary analysis tool, there's sort of a total of 9 requirements, and they group them into 3 classes. But that doesn't really matter. But what you need is to keep track of the shadow state. So that means the registers and the memory of the program as it's running. Okay. Have to be able to instrument all read and write operations. That's loads and stores. Okay, because those are the operations that modify memory. Okay, that can modify memory and registers. And then system calls. So that's the arguments, the return values of from functions, arguments and return values to from functions, registers, everything in registers and memory, and via pointers. And also the hard one, so instrumenting loads and stores, well, those are instructions. So basically those are easy to recognize in the binary. That's just what you do. But you also have to, the hard part is system calls. So we'll talk about how Valgrind does, but remember, this is all working on a binary, okay? So a binary code. So what that means is also Valgrind has to be able to parse and understand what a binary looks like, but that's well-defined, actually. There's standard formats for binaries on different systems, and actually, you know, programs can manage that if they want to. The other thing that has to, so system calls are hard because system calls are, can be, they're operating system specific, but they can also behave somewhat differently on different machines, right? So a system call looks like a function call, but it's actually not. What it is it's actually a request for an operating system service on behalf of your program. Okay, so system calls include things like any calls to do input or output, okay? Underneath, when you use the standard library to actually do I/O, underneath there's actually system calls because that actually requires access to devices, right? Whether it's a keyboard, a mouse for input, whether it's a display for output, perhaps writing to a file on disk, all those things, those types of input and output all require a system call because the operating system is going to perform that operation on behalf of your program. Your program doesn't do that directly because it doesn't have the privileges to actually do access those devices directly. Okay, it's all done mediated through the operating system. And there are other kinds of system calls for managing things like the heap, increasing the size of the heap, and all sorts of things. There's lots of system calls. What else messes with memory? Okay, so all allocation and deallocation operations in memory or registers actually also have to be instrumented. Okay, have to be able to have shadow values. Things like at startup, registers get initialized, all the static data for your program, the constants and the global data gets initialized, so that has to be sort of managed by the tool, by Valgrind. Thus, again, system calls for allocation and deallocation, that's break, mmap. Break is for changing the size of the heap, mmap is for memory mapping chunks of memory for various purposes. These are, again, standard system calls. Linux has them and other operating systems, Mac OS, whatever. Has to keep track of the stack pointer movement for function calls and returns. All the bookkeeping data for the heap. So, for example, you know, where the heap manager is and keeping track of what's allocated and not allocated. The last sort of major requirement is that what the paper calls transparent execution, which is that the program still has to run. Whatever program is running with the tool still has to run, do what it was supposed to do. Okay, the program that you're instrumenting. But it can, the one thing I think it does in addition is it can produce extra output. So extra, they call it side channel output. So writing to a file or whatever, because that's where the tool is going to actually keep track of whatever is going to actually generate results. That presumably the reason you use the tool was to actually instrument and learn something about the behavior of your program. So the tool is going to actually be able to report out what it's learning about your program's behavior. So the core provides those basic services for managing shadow values. But then the question is, what instrumentation, what's going to get instrumented? What are you going to do with those shadow values? What do you need to keep track of? Then there's tool specific code for your particular instrument, for your particular analysis tool that will plug into the Valgrind core. And it, what it does is basically Valgrind hands it chunks of code and says, what do you do? Instrument it, decide what you want to do with this chunk of code. So basically add additional information to generate values that are kept track of as part of the shadow values. How does it do this? How does it do all of this? So the core does what's called dynamic binary recompilation. So, and this is all done before the program runs. So, this is done while the program runs, at program startup and while the program runs. So a tool loads the when we call about the client program, that's the program that's actually going to execute. That's going to run inside the Valgrind tool, okay? Valgrind, along with the tool-specific code, the core recompiles it a block at a time, okay? Where a block is typically, in compiler terms, a basic block, basically all the code between two branches, okay? Between, from where the target of a branch to the a branch, okay? Because that's where control flow can change. But it recompiles it a block at a time, as the client program executes within Valgrind. So what that means is the program is actually not running all by itself. It's actually running inside the Valgrind environment. Valgrind itself, along and the tool built with Valgrind, is actually running the code, that the binary code itself. It's not running it bare on the machine. Okay. So what does the core do? What it does is it takes a code block, disassembles it into an intermediate representation. That's what we mean by an IR. Okay. The tool plugin presumably then instruments it to keep track of whatever it needs to keep track of. Okay. And then the core takes that, so the tool instruments it in the intermediate representation, which is presumably machine independent, architecture independent. The core converts that intermediate representation back to machine code to execute it. And then it executes that block of code, which has been instrumented, presumably. And sort of the nice thing about this, it's kind of like just-in-time compilation, okay? That can deal with dynamically linked libraries. It can deal with shared libraries. It can deal with dynamically generated code, okay? Because it's seeing the blocks of code as they're executed, right? Each time basically a branch happens, it gets another block of code to disassemble and resynthesize with, it presumably has been instrumented, okay? The only problem is self-modifying code, and the paper talks about basically just needing to keep track of when code modifies itself, and that's usually easy to tell because the only way code can be self-modifying is if it actually runs on, if it's actually living on the heap. It's dynamically allocated. You can't change code that's living in the code section in your program's address space, because that's got a fixed size and there's no way to change it. No good way to change it, especially if the size changes. So it's easy to tell if you have self-modifying code. And the only thing that has to happen then is, well, we'll talk about, I think we'll talk about that a little more. No, the only issue with self-modifying code is, so this process of disassembling, instrumenting, and converting back to IR, you can imagine is kind of expensive. It's like I said, like sort of, and so what the Valgrind core does is it's very similar to what just-in-time compilation does, which is once it does this once on a block of code, it actually stores the resynthesized code in a cache. And then the next time that code is executed, it actually uses the code from the cache. Now, of course, self-modifying code, what that should do is if Valgrind recognizes self-modifying code, then it can actually just not cache it. Okay, so it gets regenerated every time. So if the code changes, that's fine. Go back and disassemble and re-instrument it. So basically, don't use cached code if it's self-modifying. So this process is called disassemble and resynthesize. Okay, so again, taking the binary code, returning it into some intermediate representation, changing it, annotating it with presumably some kind of instrumentation, and then regenerating the binary, that part of the binary. That's as opposed to making a copy of the code and then annotating that copy and then using the copy. And the claim is that disassemble and resynthesize is better for heavyweight analyses. Dynance does not exactly copy and annotate. It doesn't do copy. It actually directly annotates. The only thing it copies is the one instruction that gets changed, that gets moved to around the point, around some code that gets instrumented. We'll talk about that a little later. And what makes this really hard, and why the paper goes into gory detail about why the Valgrind core is so difficult to implement, is that the tool and the Valgrind core, so you know, the additional instrumentation, the stuff that generates the instrumentation and the Valgrind core, they're actually living in the same memory with the client program, with the program that you're trying to instrument and run and collect presumably, you know, instrumentation information about. So that's the hard part, and that's why it's actually pretty impressive that they ever got this to work, because it's not so easy. Now, of course, there's a cost to this. This is the tool and all the overhead. There's a lot of overhead and time, but also it uses a fair amount of memory, okay, to keep track of all of this, all the state. The event system, it has an event system that's used to inform tools about system call activities that are not directly visible from the intermediate representation. And what that means is system calls can change. They change the state of the program. Okay, right? That's right. For example, if it has an IO call, it's going to change the memory at the address that if it's a input call, okay, say a scanf or whatever, you know, you're in C, it would be a scanf, and actually underneath that gets turned into a read. That's going to change addresses in memory, right? Whatever the data that comes back from the IO call. But the Valgrind can't instrument the operating system. It doesn't have the privileges to do that. Your program doesn't have the privileges to do that either. And so what Valgrind does is it has a system that it understands the system calls to know what's going to get changed. Okay, so again, for a disk read, for a read for a file, okay, that call, that system call specifies what the memory address, where to put the data, and how much data is going to come back. So that says which part of the memory in the program, and then again, any shadow memory that's associated with that, what needs to get updated, what's going to change, so that the tool can instrument that if it wants to. Another big problem is that how do you deal with multi-threaded programs, multi-threaded client programs here? Nothing to do with whether the core, Valgrind core is multi-threaded. This has nothing to do with that. It's more about how does Valgrind run How does a Valgrind tool run a multi-threaded program? Well, there's all sorts of issues because now you've got the shadow memory and the main memory. Remember, that's the whole point of having multiple threads, is they may share access. They may be able to access the same memory locations. And now every time a memory location is updated, the shadow memory location for that address might also need to be changed. So any instrumentation that's been keeping track of what happens to that memory location, it may actually be updating values in the shadow memory. And so that has to be an atomic operation, but if you've got multiple threads running, there's no way they may get interleaved in interesting ways. And so there could be big problems. And then the paper goes into that. This was understood, you know, long time ago, right? This is not a new problem. So the way that Valgrind deals with that problem is it only allows one client thread to run at a time. That's a big problem, right, for multi-threaded programs. But that does allow keeping updates to main and shadow memory consistent always. And the paper says it's not clear how to fix this and allow concurrent thread execution. And I actually went and looked at the current documentation for current versions of Valgrind, and they still don't have a good solution to this problem. They're still serializing execution of the threads. So what that means is that Valgrind will work on multi-threaded programs, but it can change. It would be very hard to check concurrency errors. Okay, but there are tools that do it. It's just that they have to use analysis that doesn't rely on the fact that the threads are actually running concurrently. Okay. And then the last claim that the paper makes is that the tool performance, okay, that's for tools that are built using Valgrind, is similar to that of other equivalent tools, even though it's doing this disassemble and resynthesize, which is can be a very expensive operation. That's not exactly the strongest of claims, because the slowdowns compared to running without Valgrind are still quite high. We're talking about slowdowns of factors of 5, 10 compared to straight execution. But you get the benefit of being able to do the dynamic analysis. So the current status, this is not in the paper, obviously, because the paper doesn't include what's going on currently, is that there are currently 7 production quality tools available that use the Valgrind core. There's a memory error detector, that's MemCheck. That's one's been around, that's the most heavily used one that I know of. There are a couple of thread error detectors for looking at errors in multi-threaded programs, again, with the caveat that really, in the end, only one thread is running at a time. There's a cache and branch prediction profiler. So looking at the behavior, that's, I think, called cache bind. It looks at the behavior of caches and branch prediction in your program. So if that's a performance problem, there's another version of that that looks at the call graph for a cache and branch prediction profile that looks at call graphs. And then there are a couple of different heap profilers. And then they also talk about an experimental version of a basic block, keeping track of what basic blocks your code executes, which I said that's basically a basic block is a chunk of code with only one entry and then a branch at the end. So this is chunks of code that execute without branches into them or out of them. And you can divide your program up, your binary program up into a set of basic blocks. And then the SimPoint is a simulator that can simulate the behavior of a program running basic block by basic block. So there's 7 tools that are, they call them production quality, means that they've been pretty heavily used. And the current version of Valgrind and the tools runs on pretty much every processor and operating system that's available today. So x86, ARM, MIPS, PowerPC. I think the only one I didn't see there because nobody's ready yet is like RISC-V or anything like that. But And then because of the system calls, the sort of characterizing the behavior of all those system calls, that requires a fair amount of time on the implementers, on the core implementers. So there are versions for Linux, Mac OS, Android. I noticed it didn't include iOS. There's apparently not much demand for that for whatever reason. And if you care more about learning more about the individual tools or what's going on inside Valgrind, there's all sorts of documentation on the website, which is valgrind.org. And there's more information about all these different tools, those seven tools plus that experimental tool. There's links to more information about all of those. Let me talk for a little bit about Dynance before we do questions, because it's hard to go back and forth. And I've only got three slides on Dynance also. So Dynance is quite different. Okay, it's really intended to do lightweight analysis. Okay, and it's a lightweight tool in that what it is it's a class library, a C++ class library for doing binary, static, and dynamic instrumentation. So it can statically modify the binary, okay, a binary program. But what Dynance can do, which is different from what Valgrind can do, is actually it can change the program while the program's running. This is not just disassemble and and modify, right? Disassemble and what's the disassemble and re, I always forget, and resynthesize. But it can actually sort of take a running program and stop it, even if the program runs unmodified, but it can actually stop it and instrument it while it's running. Okay, and then restart it, right? With the changed binary. Now you say, well, how the heck can it do that? Well, it's actually using operating system services, the same services that a debugger uses, to actually can have one program, in this case the Dynance mutator, what's called the mutator process, can actually control the behavior of another process. Okay. So this is lightweight infrastructure. That means that the actual instrumentation can be very lightweight because it's basically once the binary is modified, it runs without it run, it just runs, right? The way it would without any instrumentation, except it's also running the instrumentation code. So it can work on an executing program, and the code that it inserts is generated from a machine-independent description. It's basically an API. That's what the API is talking about. Is it's a way of sort of defining how your the Dynance process that's actually going to control the inserting the instrumentation and collecting the results of the instrumentation, presumably, is actually going to use a machine-independent description of the code that it's going to insert. So that way it can generate code for whatever architecture you're running on, as long as Dynance knows how to do that, which it also, again, we'll talk about the status, but it works for pretty much all modern systems. So the way it does that is it inserts what it calls snippets of, those are snippets of code into one or more client processes, so it can actually instrument multiple processes that are running on the same system. Okay, and where does it do that? It does it at what are called instrumentation points. So those are things, it's not necessarily arbitrary parts of the program. It has to be places, things like entrances, exits to functions. You have to be able to name them. So the problem here with those instrumentation points is when you write source code, the compiler can generate code that does not map you. The statements in your source code don't, it's not always obvious the one-to-one mapping of that to binary code. An optimized program may the compiler may generate, may reorder the code that it generates so that you can't actually tell which instructions generated which binary code, which binary instructions, right? It might be very difficult to do that mapping. And since Dynance runs on the bare, is working with the bare binary, right? There's nothing special about it. It can be hard for Dynance to know where to insert other than things like function call, which it's easy to find in the binary, beginnings of functions and things like that. So what happens is that the mutator process, so which is the basically the Dynance controlled process, inserts snippets into the application program. The only thing the application program had to do to allow that was that the application program was linked with the Dynance runtime library, either before runtime or as a dynamically loaded linked library. Okay, so it can actually be a statically linked or a dynamically linked library, linked and loaded library. Okay. So when I said that the implementation to do to change the a running binary uses similar OS services as operating system services as a debugger would, basically what that means is it's controlling the activity of another process. Okay. And it can control that other process's execution, okay, without that process knowing about it until it happens. Okay, and the process doesn't know, right, that that's being controlled. And it can also, the mutator process also can modify, read and modify the address space of the instrumented process, right? The whatever you call it, the client, whatever you want to call it. So to insert code into a running program or a binary, you know, a static binary, okay, not one that's running, but before it runs, Dynance has to generate code, the code to insert and know where to insert it. So what Dynance, what that mutator process does is through the API, it generates code in some intermediate representation through the API, and then actually then says generate the code that's going to be inserted, a set of instructions, okay, into a particular place in the user program, okay, whatever that instrumentation point is. And what it does is it basically says, well, there's a particular instruction, okay, a particular point before or after that instruction where the code is going to be inserted. Like I said, that's typically at the beginning or end of a function. So at the entrance to a function, at the sort of the header, or on the return call. And so it does this with two little bits of code. One they call and those are called trampolines, because all they do is really redirect the execution to the instrumentation code. Okay, so what happens is basically think about pulling a single instruction out, replacing it with a call to what's called the base trampoline. And that base trampoline has basically only does three things. One of them is that whatever instruction got pulled out, that's in the middle. And then instrumentation that can be put before or after that instruction. Okay, so that's that pre and post code. So, and those are just function calls, okay, to the code to actually do whatever the instrumentation wants to do, either before or after that instruction, or both before and after. And then the code that gets that's calls into what's called the mini trampolines for pre or post those postcode snippets. And the first, what those have to do is, again, you can't mess, the program still that's being modified still has to execute properly. So any additional instrumentation code it's going to use registers, it's going to use memory. So anything that it touches has to actually be saved and then restored, okay? So what that says is that these mini trampolines, what they do is they save and restore the registers, set up the arguments for the snippet function, and then call that snippet function, which then returns. Okay. And if you want to sort of chain together multiple snippets, they can be chained all at one place. So you can have multiple calls, so they can be chained together. There's a method for doing that. So you don't have to build one enormous one. If it's doing a lot of work, you can sort of chain together multiple little pieces. Basically somebody can write those and then they can be reused and chained together without having to sort of smash them all into one snippet. So that's kind of how it works. And then the one really interesting, there's several examples in the paper of how to use Dynans to do particular functions. But the one that's sort of really interesting is the conditional breakpoint example, which basically showed, so what's going on there is that if you're using a debugger and set a conditional breakpoint, the standard debugger like GDB or whatever debugger you use, okay, this is, you know, and allows you to, a conditional breakpoint says that only set a breakpoint, only return control back to the user to do whatever wants to do inside the debugger if a particular condition holds, which is typically looking at the value of a variable, whatever, right? So you're looking at it for a particular state, and not every time the breakpoint is reached that the execution isn't supposed to stop. But the way a standard debugger does that is it inserts an unconditional breakpoint into the code that returns control back to the debugger every time, which then checks the condition, looks at the state of the program to figure out whether or not that breakpoint should actually have happened. Okay. And so what that says is the reason that the user is inserting a conditional breakpoint is because they say probably most of the time the condition isn't going to hold, right? Otherwise you would have set an unconditional breakpoint. Okay. So the conditional breakpoint, there's a high cost to going back and forth between the debugger and the application program, the subject program. If you do this with Dynans, if you insert conditional breakpoints with Dynans, what you're doing is you're actually inserting the test for whether or not the breakpoint is supposed to happen into the code, okay, which can be done dynamically while the program is running. And so what the paper shows is that the execution cost for doing it that way is way less than having to do an unconditional breakpoint and have the debugger itself figure out whether or not the program should just continue or actually return control to the user, presumably to look at values, do whatever you want to do inside the debugger, whatever the user wants to do. So again, this is why I call it lightweight instrumentation. Basically what it's doing is when you insert instrumentation, there's a cost to actually the time you're doing it. But then once it's inserted, it's just doing whatever it does as part of the normal execution of the program. There's no additional overhead other than whatever the instrumentation is actually doing. That's the only additional cost. Those Valgrind-based tools, the reason they're so slow is because you're going through this, even with caching the recompiled code, okay, that there's still a cost even to doing that lookup and executing sort of a chunk of code at a time. There's a big cost to doing that, okay? So what's the current status of Dynans? Well, there's still an active website. It's a joint effort between Maryland. That's actually Jeff Hollingsworth, who's a faculty member of computer science, but he's also now the CIO. And that's a VP position. And he's so head of basically computing and networking and all that at the campus. And faculty members at the University of Wisconsin. The web pages talk at Dynans.org talk about a large number of tools that have been implemented with Dynans, because again, Dynans, I think, is not intended to be used directly by application developers, by people trying to debug their programs, but to build tools that use the services that it provides. So there's been a bunch of tools, that some of which I'm sure are still active. But it's not clear to me from the web pages, and I haven't asked Jeff Hollingsworth directly, if there's any active development of tools with Dynans going on now. But the framework is still supported for sure. The last release was in 2019, which I got from the downloads webpage on the website. But I think that it's still being supported. There's still actually, you know, there's active support for it. So it's not dead. So that's the current status. So I'm going to stop sharing. And now we can talk for a little while. I took less time today than I usually do. So questions, comments, is this really confusing, or do you get the basic idea? Has anybody used Valgrind or Dynance related tools, things like Memcheck? No, huh?
I've used Memcheck quite a bit.
I was going to ask. So, and what kinds of things have you used it for?
Mainly just looking for, you know, why I have a fixed seg fault in some C code. It's pretty useful for that. It gives you a lot of pretty detailed information. I took an operating systems class in undergraduate where the professor would run Valgrind on everyone's programs to look for memory leaks to make sure you'd done the assignment right.
Right. Again, be careful. You're not running Valgrind. You're running Memcheck, which uses the Valgrind core.
But right.
it generates its own. So it decides what to do with each of those code blocks, right, in terms of what it's instrumenting to actually keep track of what's going on in the memory locations, right, to see if you're doing something bad, right, like accessing something that you freed already, right, things like that, right, accessing uninitialized memory and all that kind of thing. But that's the kind of instrumentation that it inserts into those code blocks that the Valgrind core hands it, right? So what about you, Julie? You said you also used Memcheck.
Yeah, I mean, for similar purposes, finding seg faults and also memory leaks mostly. Although I have noticed that for like MPI applications or when you have more complicated libraries, the memory leak stuff kind of gets tangled up in all the stuff that the library is using. So it's not helpful then.
Right, because that code does get instrumented, but you don't necessarily have access to the source code, right? So it makes it hard to say, so what's going on, right? Because it's almost certainly in how you're using the library. It's not the library itself that's the problem, right? Typically, right? I'm not saying that there's no bugs in the libraries, but it's much more likely that you're not using it correctly in some way, which is somewhat useful to know, but not necessarily helpful to what you're trying to do, to figure out what you're doing wrong. Some of the other things, the tools, things like the cache tracing and all that, that gets into, if you want to sort of understand the cache behavior of your program, that's the cache one, right? Why is my performance so bad? Am I getting a lot of cache misses, right? Well, yeah, sure, you can look at the counters, you know, maybe, and there's tools for that. But some of these, this kind of a tool will tell you sort of what the behavior is of your program. And yeah, it's more expensive, but it probably tells you sort of what the access, why your access patterns are so bad, right, for cache. So any questions about how things work or, you know, other things about these binary analysis tools?
So I guess one question that comes to mind, if I can just go for it, is what would be like an example of a tool you could create with Dynance that you wouldn't be able to do with something like Valgrind?
So I think you can probably do almost anything with either one. It's a question of how easy or hard it is, right? So, you know, Valgrind, the core, gives you sort of a lot of power because it's doing all the work to maintain the shadow memory for you, right? So if you want to build a tool using the Valgrind core, all you really have to do is figure out what instrumentation do I want to add to the code, right? That's what the tool does on top of the basic services that the core gives. The cost of that is that your program is going to the instrumented program, the one that's running inside Valgrind, the same way you run a program inside a debugger, okay, the cost of that is very high because of the model, which is basically, you know, extract chunks of code, turn them into the IR, instrument them, run them. Even caching that, there's still the cost of for each chunk of code, for each basic block, really what it amounts to, look up into the cache, run it, look up the next, figure out what's the next block of code to run, do that. Even once the process has been done once, you still have to go to the cache for every chunk of code. So there's a very high cost to that. Okay. But for the tool developer, really all it is figuring out, what do I want to do with those shadow values? What do I want to do? What additional instrumentation do I want to add, okay, to each block of code, right? So building a tool using that. Now, the dine-in services are very lightweight. All it's doing basically is what dine-in is giving you is the ability to go into a running program, say, in that part of the code, add these instructions, which presumably again is some kind of instrumentation, right? You could, not a good idea, but you could change the behavior of the program at runtime. Dynance will let you do that. You can change the running binary, right? Not a good idea, right? It should only really update, you know, to do additional things, not change the behavior, the existing behavior of the program, okay? But it's much, tools built with Dynance, it's a lot more work for the tool developer because the services are pretty minimal, right? All it's giving you is the ability to write code in a machine independent manner. You don't have to write, you know, x86 assembly code or anything like that, or generate a binary, like binary code. But you still have to, through the API, generate the, what is it you want to do at each of those instrumentation points? Okay, and that can include things like, well, I need to allocate some memory to actually keep track of the data that I want to, for my instrumentation. So it can get really messy. So the execution cost in terms of how fast the instrumentation runs is low because it's running in line. Once the code's generated, it just runs. Okay, but the building tools with Dynance is much harder. And again, the teams at Maryland and Wisconsin have built some tools to help with that, right? Some language-based tools to help writing the code snippets, but it's not so easy. Okay, I actually had a research project from a set of students who built a very simple tool using Dynance. I'd have to go back and look. I really don't remember exactly what it did, but it was and they spent 6 or 8 weeks doing a very simple tool on top of Dynance because just there's a very high startup cost to even to being able to do anything useful with that Dynance API. But again, when you're done, once the tool's that's very lightweight instrumentation. It's not, you're modifying the program, but then it just runs doing additional things besides what it originally did. Right. There's no additional cost besides whatever the extra code that's running and a few extra branches, right? Because of the putting in the extra code.
That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. I see here there was a question about using Dynance, for example, to debug MPI or OpenMP programs. So there's no reason that you couldn't have a Dynance mutator running sort of alongside each of your MPI processes. But again, you're going to have to control now all your MPI processes separately, right? So maybe you would need an MPI Dynance mutator, right, to actually control your MPI program. And I don't know of anybody who's done that. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I don't know of anybody who's done that. And you can certainly use Dynance on an OpenMP program. Again, you'd have to instrument the code. It would probably be really messy to do it in a parallel section, But there's no reason you couldn't, because again, an OpenMP program, what it is underneath what it's using is whatever the native threads on your machine are, typically pthreads. But then the compiler is generating the calls to create the threads and assign them work. Okay, so by the time it gets to the binary, it just looks like a multi-threaded code, which can be instrumented the same way you can instrument a single-threaded code, as long as you get put the instrumentation in the right places, right? Because again, it's going to update the binary, which the threads presumably are, you know, they're all running parts of the same code, right? They're running whatever function that they're running. So once you instrument it, probably the thing to do is you would want to make sure you know which thread you're running and ask, right? There's calls to do that. Which thread am I? And then do whatever you want to do for your instrumentation. So there's no reason that something like Dynance could not be used to instrument OpenMP code. That should be pretty straightforward. Because it's working on the binary. The fact that you have multiple threads, well, they're all using the same binary, right? It's one shared memory space. That it would be much more complicated for MPI when you have multiple processes with separate address spaces. They would each need to be controlled separately. Is that pretty clear? I hope. Paolo's shy, but he asked a question about the amount of memory needed when you use shadow values in Valgrind. How much memory is needed? Well, yeah. Think about now, for every memory location, every register, there's got to be additional data. The shadow values are additional data about the data in that memory location. So you're certainly going to increase the memory footprint of the program that's running by a lot. Okay. Factor two, factor three, depends how much instrumentation, what you're keeping track of, right, with the tool. Okay, if it's cache accesses, you've got counters going on, you know, for each of the memory locations. If you're doing, if it's something like what memcheck does, which is keeping track of allocations and pointer accesses and things like that, that could be all the reads and writes in your program. So it's instrumenting them. So there's going to be a cost, but there's also going to be, you need space to actually keep track of those counters, right? What's going on with each of the memory locations in your program. So it's going, like I said, double, triple, maybe the size of your program, the size of the data for your program. So there is a pretty high cost.
Thank you.
Does anybody want to ask any other questions? I have more, but I think a lot of what people ask has already been covered. Have I missed anything? No?
I guess one thing that comes to mind, just to clarify, you may have already explained this in the lecture, but how much control do you have over where points can be with Dynance? Is it completely arbitrary, or is it just like named regions or scopes?
I think the issue is being able to name the point, right? So that's easy enough for a function call, because that's going to actually appear, you know, there's going to be an actual function call with that as the target, right? Most processors have an instruction, which is a function call, right? Because a function call is a little different from a branch, right? Or a jump, because it not only has to start execution at whatever the target of the function is, but it also has to push the return address onto the stack. That's typically, and you want that as an atomic operation, right? So there's typically a single instruction. And so it's easy enough to know now where the first instruction in that function is, Okay. Same way, it's easy enough to know where there's also typically a return instruction, which does the inverse operation. It pops the return address off and then jumps to that address to go back to where you were, right, before the function call. That's popping off the stack. And then there's all the code to on entry and exit from a function call to deal with the parameters and the return values and all that. But that's the first thing and the last thing are the function call, instructions of the function call, and the last thing is the return. And so those are easy points to find in the code in the binary. If there are other labeled points in the code, then it's possible to find them using Dynast, but you have to be able to name them. That's the problem because it is a binary.
Okay.
And yeah, the Dynast will work, but not as well with what's called strip binaries, which means that you've actually removed most binaries include the symbol table, which maps like where locations are relevant. Where things are, like where the beginning of each function is, what address the beginning of each function is, other labels, things like global variables, which you know statically, they're not dynamically allocated, things like that. It can keep track of where things are. But if you do what's called stripping the binary, which makes it smaller because it removes the symbol table, then you don't even have that the tool doesn't even have access to that information. So there's no way to even, you know, given the name, which is in the source code, yeah, but it's not in the binary. So how could you find it? so that's a problem. But individual function calls, that's there. That is in the binary. And so those can certainly, that's the minimum that you always get is entry and exit from a function. And function include methods for, you know, in say C++ or C++ programs, methods are functions. They just happen to have extra parameters that don't look like parameters in the source code, but they are anyway. They're still function calls. So
this,
please.
Something that comes to mind when you say that is, I wonder if there's, or if you're aware of any sort of interaction with the Dynast tool with the practice of like reverse engineering binaries or like reverse compilation. Is this something that's actively being used for those purposes, or is it inspired research in that area?
I was going to say, I think Dynast also goes back a long time, right? More than 20 years. And at that time, there were very few tools. There were a couple of others that did some similar things in terms of messing with binary. But since then, there's been lots of tools, lots of research on binary analysis. Okay, because it's hard because the binary doesn't have anywhere near as much information in it as the source code. Okay, but the fact is look. If a lot of modern code uses libraries, dynamically links in libraries, you don't even know what code's going to execute at compile time. You don't have access to all the code statically. Okay, so the only thing you can do is do dynamic analysis of the binaries, and you actually have to do it at runtime because you don't even know what codes, you don't even know what code you're going to link in dynamically until it happens at runtime. Because it depends on, that's going to come from somewhere in the system that you're running on, right? It's going to go find that the code to run at runtime, depending on, you know, how paths are set up or whatever, you know, whatever the environment is that the code's running. So it's not even possible for a lot of analyses to do them statically. If you need access to all the code that's going to execute, if you want to analyze, do some analysis over all the code that executes while a program is running, right? You don't know that statically. You can't. So there have been a lot of tools that have done this, and I think they go back to things like Dynast and similar tools back then. Those methods were sort of pioneered by those groups. Right, and how to go about doing that analysis. And there are other papers that talk about sort of really how you go about finding the stack and walking up the stack of a binary, right, a runtime stack. So at any point in time in the program, there's a certain set of functions that are active, and you can go find in the memory of the stack and go and look at all the variables. That's what a debugger has to do, right? So it's possible to do, but it's not easy, right? And that's why most debuggers ask a debugger, if you want to debug your program, you ask the compiler to generate additional information into the binary so that the debugger can do its job. Right? You can't just run the, if you run the debugger on a binary that was just generated without debugger, the information the debugger wants, basically all it can tell you is what thing is currently executing. It can't actually go up and down the stack and tell you about, it doesn't have a good way to map, always to map variable names to memory locations and all that. It has much more limited information. That's why when you compile with, say, with C compiler, C++ compiler, you use the minus G flag, right? What that does is that tells the compiler to generate all sorts of additional information so the debugger can figure out what the heck is going on. Well, that's all well and good for a debugger. If the debugger, if your compiler writer is willing to do that for you, but not all tools have that power, right? That the only reason you can do that is because the compiler writers were willing to do that so that programs written and use that compiler can actually be debugged. Right? They decided that was important enough for them. And that information, of course, would also be very useful to tools like Dynast or other dynamic analysis tools. So okay, does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
So if nobody has any burning questions, I'm happy to end a few minutes early today. Everybody okay with that? Okay, so our next time, let me see, what are we doing next time? Next week we'll talk about runtime parallelization and auto-tuning. Couple more types of tools. For runtime parallelization is for making programs with irregular data access patterns run faster in parallel. And auto-tuning is about making programs that are hard to optimize run faster, basically by learning as they're running. That's what auto-tuning is about, basically figuring out the values of various parameters. So that's what we'll talk about next week. And if all goes well, I will have your OpenMP programs created by sometime next week. That's the plan. And you'll get back a report just like you got back for the MPI program. Similar type of report. Okay? Okay, then I guess I'll see everybody on Tuesday in person. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.